Spotswood's friend and my friend, Gus Mead, and the great work they've done and the music that Dick has exposed to me. So I'm going to turn this over to Dick to tell you about the project that he's been working on and has just completed, the discography, bibliography that Charles K. Wolfe called the most important reference work of the last 20 years, I think. So let me turn it over to Dick. Thanks, Dick.
Thank you, Sam. There's a book, and it's out. I saw my publisher and buddy Steve Weiss walk in a little while ago. Steve, are you here from University of North Carolina, who helped shepherd this? Anyway, I'll come to that. I've got some prepared remarks and some music that I would like to share with you. Nothing so profoundly moving as that statement from John Coltrane about Alabama. I was listening to that and feeling very, very upstaged. That was so beautiful. It was a sad but very distinct privilege to be asked to pick up where my friend Gus Mead left off when he died suddenly in February of 1991, when he was very much in the midst of preparing a major reference book about old songs, where they came from, what happened to them in print, and in the 20th century world of recorded sound. Gus would be very proud to be here today and proud to see the work that he began completed, well, published anyway. Works like this, of course, are never entirely complete. He'd be proud to see his work brought to fruition by his oldest son, Doug, who is not here with us today, but who helped me celebrate the publication of the book last month at University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and delivered, Doug did a very eloquent address on his own. In any case, Gus was peeking over both of our shoulders for many, many years as we worked on it in his absence, and found ourselves being forced to make some choices that he didn't have a chance to make for himself, and hoping that we made the right ones. As a music writer and broadcaster, Country Music Sources in its draft form over the past 20-odd years or so came to my aid on countless occasions, giving me historical access to hundreds of songs and hymns and dance tunes. I've been doubly fortunate in having the opportunity to contribute and amplify on my own the structure that Gus created. It's the structure itself, I think, that's remarkable. Because it was so imaginative and so very innovative, not only for its time when Gus began, which is really, I suppose, the idea germinated in his imagination back in the 1950s when he was still a young scholar and fiddle player and wondering, you know, where old songs and dance tunes came from. So ultimately, Gus decided to bring the discography and bibliography disciplines together to focus on old songs, to summarize their history both in print and as sound documents, grouping multiple versions of a song together regardless of title. Mike and Alan passed out some sample pages from the book, and you can see that in many cases you just have to know what's on those recordings to know that these things with various titles are in reality different versions of the same composition. This is from the days really before everything became copyrightable, and old songs could and did appear under many different names. So, Country Music Sources had to be more than simply a discography, since many or even most of the songs and hymns and dance tunes are older than the records themselves, and thus records form only a portion of the song's genealogy. Country music, especially in the early years before the growth and expansion of BMI-affiliated music publishers in Nashville and elsewhere, retained both material and performance styles of the popular music of previous generations. So printed and recorded sources become essential to understanding a song's origins and subsequent dissemination. For organizing purposes, Gus Mead created a sophisticated system of subject categories covering both secular and sacred songs and, of course, dance music. These subject headings delineate and sort out the universe of the things we sing about in popular music, even the tempos that we dance to, and Gus managed to find a place for everything within an intelligent framework. My contribution, at least in part, was to enlarge on Gus's original scope. The universe of old hillbilly music was fairly large. Gus originally limited his documentation efforts to pre-war hillbilly records, specifically those made between 1923 and the popular 78 RPM discographical cutoff date, 1942. Toward the end of his life, Gus saw fit to include some African-American versions of songs that were also on hillbilly discs. Taking my posthumous cue from him, I have taken the liberty of enlarging that universe still further, adding more versions of the songs from African-American sources, taking field recordings from the Library of Congress and other institutions. And having gone that far, I thought it would also be a good idea to include newer versions of the songs that show up on post-war records. Bluegrass musicians in particular maintain an affinity for old songs, but other country performers have followed that example over the years too, especially during the folk revival of the early 1960s. And of course, the one that seems to have come about again within the last couple of years in the wake of the movie and the gazillion-selling soundtrack to Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which historically was, the movie at least, was not entirely sound. Pappy O'Daniel was not the governor of Mississippi, as any Texan could tell you. But musically, it was on a much surer footing. Any case, I also, after deciding to include some newer versions of these songs that came from interesting places, decided to comb through early catalogs so that I could include at least representative versions of Tin Pan Alley songs in the late 19th and early 20th centuries that appeared on our earlier cylinder and disc records, which in turn circulated throughout the rural and urban landscape in America at the time and formed at least part of the climate for those songs to reappear again in the 1920s and 1930s as country music documents. Thus, the work, as published, retains Gus's original framework and song list, to which I have simply enlarged the number of citations and played sort of free and easy with some of the criteria. I did mention Doug Mead, who threw himself wholeheartedly into getting country music sources completed. Gus had experimented with early computers and early computer programs, creating databases that were never quite able to meet his ambitious needs. Doug helped improve that situation when Gus was alive and worked out a very sophisticated database after Gus's death. Doug also created the title and performer indices as much by hand as by automation. These were tedious and time-consuming jobs, but the look and usefulness of the final product owes a great deal to Doug Mead. Noblesse oblige also strongly requires thanks to Archie Green, to the late Ed Cowan, to the John Edwards Memorial Foundation, whose home is presently at, once again, at University of North Carolina. These folks and all have really encouraged publication of the final work. And I'm glad he's here because I owe Steve Weiss a big round of thanks to Steve and the Southern Folklife Center, of which he has charge at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. The center and Steve became godfathers to country music sources, creating a fine, readable, sturdily bound example of the bookmaker's art. If you've had a chance to heft the book, you'll be amazed that something so big, so nicely and sturdily bound, and so visually attractive is also available for a $90 list price. And if that's a commercial plug, so be it. I'm not making the money. It is a remarkably low price for something so big and cumbersome. And that's important because country music, hillbilly music, doesn't come from wealthy people that can afford luxuriously prepared limited editions. Getting the information in country music sources back to the communities that generated the music to begin with is important, and I'm grateful that the book is attractive and affordable, and that I am starting to hear not just from the critical mavens like Charlie Wolfe and Bill Malone and people like that who have indeed said nice things about the book, but from Dolly Parton, who shortly before the conference that we had at UNC sent Steve Weiss an extremely nice note and let him know in no uncertain terms that the book had a prominent place on her bookshelf. And Dolly has always been enough of a trendsetter that I think that her example will be followed by others. I'm not going to be able to upstage Steve, is it Roland or Rowland? Anyway, it's look like Roland. That delightful presentation with those eloquently played examples of John Coltrane's music. But just for a few examples of basically of the kind of thing that I was talking about when I said the tunes traveled, the tunes had different titles, and they showed up in very, very different ways. What I want is, I will, if I may, I've got to borrow this because I forgot to keep the copy of the top sheet with the song titles on it. From this, you can gather where to look to see how the particular page would be used as the reference on country music sources. This, sir, will be the cassette that I gave you, and we'll hear the three distinctly different versions of Poor Boy. It was an old song. Basically, all that these versions have in common is there's a basic melody to them, and of course it's in waltz time in all three versions. That's not necessarily the case throughout the Poor Boy discography, but it is here. Three different titles, none of which is Poor Boy, and I don't think we have too many lyric clusters in common. And those of you who know folk songs will see some links to even other songs that you may or may not necessarily associate with this little complex. So if you would, please. I cued this before I left home. I probably should have done this again because it works. Thank you.
until I see that you go free. I see that you go free, oh boy, I see that you go free. If you need more than months until I see that you go free. I told my age was 21, the truth I told at time. Before I report that moonshine till I'll go and serve my time. I'll go and serve my time, poor boy, I'll go and serve my time. Before I report that moonshine till I'll go and serve my time.
That was me. I think I did. We end it there. It was not very ceremonial. But anyway, it was enough for you to get the idea. And I think you can see glancing at the page where it really is useful to bring all of those things together, where no one could have done it that hadn't actually sat down and listened to all of these things, so that we could determine that a song about a gambler, a highwayman, and somebody who wouldn't report, you know, an illicit still, were in fact all different chapters of the same story. I want to allow some time for questions, but I also wanted to play another example here. The flop-eared mule is perhaps the most remarkable example of this kind of free-floating tune that I've ever seen, because here we even go across national lines. The Fiddling Powers recording was made in Winston-Salem in 1927. The Ukrainian recording was made just across the river in Camden in 1930. The Ukrainska Selska Orchestra were Camden Ukrainian musicians who were active in the Philadelphia community in 1930 when they made a group of records for what had just recently become RCA Victor. They were no longer the Victor Talking Machine Company. The third example comes from a group of cylinders that were recorded by an early folklorist. I have these long play records. They're entirely in Swedish, and the text is, so I can't tell exactly what the whole story of their origin and usefulness, but they were published by Columbia Records in Sweden in 1974 and 75. And one of them was this Wislare Polska by a country fiddler from Småland. Harry Schultz is, as everyone knows, the guy who gave Jolie Blonde to the world in the late 1940s. In 1940, he was an important member of Happy Fats's Rainbow Ramblers, and the polka A Gilbert, which is actually played in Schottish time. The Cajuns called Schottish as polkas for reasons best known to themselves. This recording comes from 1940. The Mahanoy City, Pennsylvania, Lithuanian Miners Orchestra is from 1933. Carl Sossman, who is still living down in Donaldsonville, Louisiana, was one of the bluegrass pioneers. This recording of Asheville is not strictly speaking by a bluegrass band. There's a mandolin, I think. Yeah, that's right. His brother played the mandolin, but no five-string banjo, which has over the years become the sine qua non of a bluegrass band. But you'll notice once again that we have six versions of a tune called The Flop-Eared Mule. Not one of them is called The Flop-Eared Mule.
Everybody, wing on, wing. the hat up.
Now, here's all the Green Valley boys bunched up together, and when they get together, I'm telling you. Oh, brother, especially when Arville Freeman starts off on the fiddle something like this, an old-time tune called Asheville.
Starting out in North Carolina and winding up back in North Carolina, traveling through Eastern Europe and Louisiana, a tune that traveled very widely, both in terms of time and space. I've managed to leave. That's good. That works out just about according to my plan. Sam's got a little timer up here that tells all of us how much time we have, and every speaker's podium should have one of these. Mine just clicked on to 8 minutes, which means that we've got time for Q&A or critiques or what you got, Kurt?
How clear is the line of demarcation between different tunes? I'm sure some of these are very close. How do you determine whether or not it's the same thing?
Well, they're not identical. That's a good question for, say, a Bach borrowing from Vivaldi. I think the situation here, and that was a fairly fluid situation, but I think the situation here is even more so. I don't know. I mean, tell me what's the source of your question. Did you hear something that didn't belong?
Well, to my untrained ear, I heard things that I wouldn't just hop right up and say, well, that's the same thing I just listened to. And not just the ones that you picked, but I know that there are songs that over the years, there's maybe a clear progression, but if you compare song A to song Z, there's no obvious connection between the two. So at what point do you say, okay, now this is something new?
Well, at some point, you just have to decide whether the totality of a single performance, I won't say composition, because a lot of these are a little short of formal composition. You did something else to get it onto a recording. The totality, bears an overall resemblance. Or in the case of Flop-Eared Mule, which has two sections, the second section might not be there. In which case, you'd only have sort of a half of a flop-eared mule if you didn't have the second part of the melody. I don't know. I mean, I thought all of these examples were fairly self-evident, and maybe they weren't. Anyone? Yeah, way back there. What? I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
Well, no, the first part has nothing to do with it. The second part is, are there more titles than the ones that you've given us on the
script now? Quite possibly. I just Xeroxed sample pages, and I was more interested in impressing you with the great number of titles than to give you every single one, because I knew you'd want to buy the book. Yeah, there's some connection there. Steve. I don't know about anybody else, but I can hear better if we'll stand up. Gus Mead. These were his titles. And I would mess with things, but since, say, especially Flop-Eared Mule was a very obvious. Well, no, that's actually there are a lot of big-eared mules that were used. Flop-Eared Mule tends to be the slightly better known title. It was Gus's choice in any case, and so I would not have changed it. Poor Boy is sort of a generic title that people into the discipline will know, but ultimately. It is arbitrary. You try to select the title that represents the largest part of the universe that you're trying to delineate. And since it is something of an arbitrary choice, once you've done it and once you put it in print, even if you screw it up, it'll tend to become the authority anyway, you know? Carrie? Stand up. I would hope that this book would open up a lot of dissertation topics. That would certainly be a good one. My own feeling is that dance tunes have no language barriers. And you don't have to be able to understand the words to play the tune. I suspect that the tune probably came from Eastern Europe in the first place. And there is somewhere along the line, I'm almost sure I've even heard an Irish version of it. But clearly the tune in some way or other got around. All I can do at this point, and all I tried to do for the book, was to just demonstrate that it happened. The hows and the whys, I think, are very intriguing, and whether it's still possible to learn that at this late date, I don't know. Tim? Sure.
Do you see, not only this era, but beyond that, the point at which there's a diminution in that? Or is there really a sample today, for example?
This is another topic that I love to expound on, and so I'm going to force myself to be short here. And I mentioned it very briefly, the establishment of BMI in 1940-41, whenever that ASCAP strike went on, caused BMI, Broadcast Music Industries, to be set up. One of their first manifestations was the Acuff Rose Publishing Corporation in Nashville, which was published with Roy Acuff's money, of which he had a whole lot, and songwriter Fred Rose's Music Industry Smarts. And the two of them founded Acuff Rose on a handshake. Jesus. Nobody violated any confidences and nobody went to jail. I really did misspeak. I also got 1 minute left here. The corporation was founded on a handshake. Neither of them knew how much money it was going to make, because all of a sudden, country music songs were commodities that could be copyrighted, published, and royalties earned on, and it turned hillbilly music around in the 1940s from what it had been in the 1930s. Carey's great discography of Western swing is full of examples of deliberately distorted titles where Western bands would record Ace in the Hole and call it An Ace, or record H, She's Sweet and call it She's Sweet, simply in order to avoid paying copyright royalties. That became a lot less viable in 1940. My time is up. Is there anything, Mike?
Well, remember that all of these bands were also doing live performances constantly. These are only the manifestations of it. There are other influences and other migrations of the songs and other copyings of the songs in the live performances that all of these groups were doing and hearing each other. So this is, and also I find it interesting that here now we have the release dates when you know them, and there's the only point at which the record could have an influence, that an unreleased record and a record with a recording date with a release date several years later does not have an influence as a record until it is released. But these performances were still being done live, and so there is influence probably even before, or potential influence even before the recordings were made, because they may have been playing these songs for years in live performances before they actually got a record.
I'll just stress again that's why this book also includes a bibliography, because items in the bibliography tend to be older than the recordings, and you have to consider everything sort of as being of a piece. So that's a very good point. Sam?
There's some nice coffee and snacks out there in addition to the auction. But please try to come back at 9:45 so we can get started again.